Thank you, Andrew. And so I must disappoint everyone who's here to listen to a talk on quantum spins, because there's almost nothing on quantum spins in here. So there was at some point last night, but at 2 a.m. I decided it was going to be no way I could talk about it in 25 minutes. So there it goes. Anyway, I trust everyone has had a nourishing breakfast and is ready to listen to a talk on chaos and quantum mechanics. So this is a rather old topic, and in fact, you know, Einstein was the first person who contributed to it in his comments on the old-fashioned quantization schemes, where he argued that if you have a non-integrable classical system, then those methods would not work. And of course, there's a field of quantum chaos that exists for a long time. But today I want to talk about something somewhat different, where I want to ask the question, which is there chaos in quantum mechanics? And if so, you know, how should we define it? How should we look for it? What possible experiments can we do, and so forth? So I want to begin by basically pointing out what the key issues are and how they might be resolved, and at least what our thoughts on the matter are. And then I want to discuss some recent results where we have, we think, pretty much conclusive evidence of how chaos can be seen in quantum systems and next generation experiments that might see it. So there's a sequence of papers starting in about 2000 going up to 2006. This talk mostly concerns work with Kurt Jacobs, who's now at UMass, Kosuke Shizumi, who's at Tsukuba, but the other people mentioned have all contributed in some way or the other. So even though people working on quantum chaos were not primarily driven by understanding why quantum systems are or are not chaotic, they were basically asking a question, what are the quantum mechanical properties of systems for which the Hamiltonians may be non-integrable? Nonetheless, the question did come up of how come classical mechanics has chaos and at least naively quantum mechanics doesn't. And there's a very nice paper by Chirikov in 1991 where in the introduction he says, this must have something to do with measurement theory, but since no one understands measurement theory, I'll ignore the problem and go on. So the interesting thing is that, you know, a lot has happened since 91. Now you might think, well, gee, you know, 91 was just pretty recently, and surely we understand quantum mechanics. But actually, even up to the mid-90s, I would argue that formalisms such as the quantum trajectory formalism and so forth were viewed with a certain amount of skepticism and, in fact, fear by certain people. Like, this is not really quantum mechanics, it's something strange. But, you know, all that's in the past. And, you know, as Todd gave a very clear talk on weak measurements yesterday, you know, everyone should be familiar with these concepts. So I'll sort of zoom through the first several transparencies. Okay, so this is something that people should just, actually I'm just reminding everybody that quantum mechanics is completely crazy, right? We don't really have a good intuition for it. As Debbie talk yesterday was a good example, right? You know, if you ask a question, the audience just like sits there like, there's a trick question because quantum mechanics is involved, right? So it's extremely important to understand that the reason why some of these things that seem so obvious today were not properly understood in the 20s and 30s, not because people are not as smart. They were much smarter than we are. It's just that quantum mechanics happens to be so strange. So one problem, for example, that did not get addressed properly for a long time is the question of, you know, what exactly is the quantum to classical transition? Are classical mechanics and quantum mechanics two completely different worldviews? Can they connect somehow? You know, how should one connect them? And this is something that I think people have had a kind of reasonable attitude towards much more recently. So one of the important points that was made in the 30s was a very simple point, which is that quantum mechanics and classical mechanics are entirely different theories, right? They have completely different axioms, they behave completely differently yet. And we are certain that quantum mechanics describes pretty much everything now, that is. But, you know, in the 20s and 30s, the view was that there was a quantum micro world and there was a classical macro world, and the two theories somehow, worked in different sectors. And the idea that the H-bar-0 limit somehow connected them isn't really right, because it's a singular limit and it's well recognized even in Landau and Lipschitz where this point is made. But now our point of view is somewhat different, which is that quantum mechanics really is a theory of the world, right? Quantum field theory describes everything. And if that's really the case, then how come, you know, we see classical mechanics at work? So there are different views of this in the sense that you could try and ask questions at the level of closed or isolated evolution, where you consider systems evolving without any coupling to the external world. So I'll call this the LUVO sort of equation point of view. And then there's the unconditioned open evolution, that is to say, you say, well, there's no system in reality, it's completely isolated, it must evolve coupled to some environment. So this is a point of view that people who do statistical mechanics have followed since the 1950s. And I'll call this, the, classically speaking, the Fokker-Planck point of view. And then there's another point of view which the control theorists have followed since the 1950s, and systems engineers, you know, who are much more forward-thinking than physicists, and which is that, you know, everything that's relevant is observed dynamics. So you better have an understanding of how you do observations. And this, of course, goes back to Einstein and, in fact, Maxwell, who started the entire field of control theory. And here what happens is that you basically add in to the Fokker-Planck equation in the unconditioned open evolutions the idea that the distribution function is also evolving because I'm making measurements on the system. And this is the conditioned Fokker-Planck equation, which is in classical theory, it's called in control theory, it's called the Kushner-Stjatanovich equation. And then the right way to think about this is sort of, I would like to call this a modern view, you know, but people who don't agree with me can call it something else. But basically, the idea of the quantum classical transition is to start with what's called the stochastic master equation, which I'll describe very briefly, and see how trajectory-like equations come out from it, which will be Langevin-like or Newton-like equations. So this is really the right way to think about how classical mechanics arises, for example. Classical mechanics can be viewed as a completely probabilistic theory, starting with the LUVEL equation, and then, you know, you can derive by following a chain of argument, which I'll describe for the quantum system, basically the Newton equations. So the problem of the quantum classical transition is also similar to the problem of how do I get effectively Newton's equations or Langevin equations given a classical probabilistic system on which I am continuously doing observations. So it's actually not a very conceptually hard problem to think about. Okay, so that's sort of the background. Now, as I said, you know, one of the important things to keep in mind is that these kind of weak measurements, for example, that Todd discussed yesterday, are actually now, at least in principle, fairly easy to set up, although experimentalists will disagree with me on in practice how hard that is. So since Keith is not here, I just wanted to show a simple example of one such continuous position measurement scheme, which in this case happens to be a nanoresonator, which is this very thin silicon nitride guitar string, which is coated with a gold layer. And it's very close to a single electron transistor, which acts as a position sensor. So as a nanoresonator moves this way, it modulates the drain source current in the SET. And from that current, you can figure out what the position of the resonator is. And then you can even control it by changing a potential on the actuating electrode. So there are models for these things. You can write down complicated master equations. And in fact, there's a milestone measurement of such a nanoresonator, which was reported very recently in Nature by Keith's group, where for the first time they've actually seen the back action of the position measurements on a nanoresonator. So basically, all of these weak measurement technologies and mathematics that I'm going to be describing are now pretty much hardcore reality. So let's first start with unconditioned open evolution. I won't really say much about closed evolution because that is something that's not relevant at all. Mostly in condensed matter physics, people are used to seeing unconditioned open evolution through the use of master equations, Galois-Leggett formalism, et cetera. And so let's start with that. So one of the first questions to ask is, well, maybe if I couple systems and environment, you know, I'll get some master equation. Is it that there are some magical properties of this master equation that enforces a quantum to classical transition in some way? So in some sense, this is sort of, I would call this a naive decoherence program. And so the idea is that if you write the master equation using a Wigner function formalism, then in Wigner functions, of course, as all of you know, there's a sort of classical evolution term, there's a quantum term. This is a very simple master equation that I'm showing. It's of a single particle coupled to a high temperature heat bath, and then there is a diffusion term, which for the purpose of this discussion is sufficient to represent the environment. So the naive diffusion decoherence argument goes like this. This diffusion there is a classical part which you like if you want the quantum classical transition to happen, and there is this nasty quantum piece which generates quantum interference terms. So if you actually were to do an analysis of a two-slit experiment, you would find that this is in fact the term that generates all the interference there. And if that's the only mystery of quantum mechanics, as Feynman said, then, well, we want to kill it. Right? And the idea is that the diffusion term, which basically smooths things out, will smooth the interference term out. And somehow, if it's sufficiently small, then the only thing you will be left with is this piece. So the problem with this argument is that it sounds seductive, but actually it's technically wrong. And the reason it's technically wrong is that, amusingly enough, let's for the moment consider only closed system evolution. So the diffusion term vanishes, in which case clearly the equation on the right, is a unitary operator, quantum mechanically. But you can show that individually this term violates unitarity, and individually this term violates unitarity. So if you have an argument where you say this term sort of disappears and a dominant term that's left is something that's unitarity violating, that simply cannot happen. So what happens is that the argument that there are slow classical pieces left behind is unfortunately not true. There are also slow quantum pieces left behind that the diffusion term must leave behind in order for the whole evolution to be positive. It doesn't have to be completely positive, but it has to be positive. So it turns out that it's fairly simple to come up with counterexamples to a naive decoherence argument. So therefore, decoherence by itself doesn't work. Now, I must say that there is one very interesting point which is completely not understood at the moment. It turns out that some systems violate, unitarity really badly. Like some classical terms that have a very large violation of quantum unitarity, and other evolutions will not. And apparently, chaos has nothing to do with this. In other words, some chaotic systems are sort of nice. They have small violations. Some chaotic systems have large violations. And there's no theory for it. So if someone wants to think about it, that's a good problem. So then the next step is to go on to conditioned evolution, where basically you ask the question, where do trajectories come from? And there's an old history of asking questions of this kind. Quantum field theory is a good example. When people try to extend quantum field theory to curved spaces, they couldn't come up with a natural notion of what a particle is. So everyone fell back on the idea that a particle is what a particle detector detects. So this is a very reasonable attitude. So in quantum mechanics, our attitude is that basically if you want to know what the position of a particle is what a position detector detects, right? So you have to model not only the original problem, but also how the detection process works. And that's the whole idea behind this work on weak measurements that Todd already told you about. And you have to keep in mind that the evolution of measured systems is very different from the usual open case, because obviously information is now available. So the evolution of the distribution function changes not only because of the Hamiltonian, not only because of the environmental coupling, but also because of the fact that you have gained more information. So basically you might imagine two approaches to the quantum classical transition. One way is simply compare distributions, like say a classical distribution and quantum distribution, and ask the question, when do quantum and classical distributions look pretty similar? And another one, which is a stronger statement of this problem, is you might say, well, how can I see classical trajectories emerge from the study of observed quantum systems? So this is basically the aspect that I'll be talking about. Of course, if the second one holds, then the first one literally follows, because an average over the second produces the first. But it's not true that if the first thing happens, then the second automatically follows. Now, the problem is that all of this means that you have to deal with conditioned master equations. And conditioned master equations are extremely painful objects, as anyone who's tried simulating them knows. But it turns out that supercomputers are finally approaching the point where at least we can deal with this fairly accurately in 1+1 dimensions. And recently, I've done stuff which is unpublished in 2 dimensions. And Los Alamos is a good place to do this kind of thing. So let me give you an example of a simple position measurement. And so this is pretty much the same mass equation we saw earlier, except now what has happened is that there's a conditioning term that's been introduced, which basically takes into account what the measurement is doing. And this is fairly standard stuff. You can read about it in the various references that actually are on the first slide. The important thing to keep in mind is that there's a record, which is the top equation, which basically is the expected result plus the fact that whenever you do an experiment, you always get some unexpected information, right? Because if you always got what was expected, you wouldn't be doing the experiment. And therefore, the DW term is that innovation, the fact that the experiment told you something new. And K here is something called a measurement strength, which basically is how strongly you're coupled to the position detector. So I don't expect people to, if you haven't seen this equation before, to jump up for joy and say, hey, you know, that's pretty obvious. But it's not really obvious, but you know, if you think about it, it becomes obvious. Okay. So the important thing to keep in mind is that the difference between the evolution of a classical master equation, which also has measurement in it, is that the conditioning term is exactly the same. But of course, the quantum interference terms are missing. And most importantly, the quantum back action term is also missing in the classical case. That's because quantum mechanically measurements are active, classically they're not. Okay, so basically what happens is, in the context of position measurements, you make position measurements, you end up localizing the state, it follows some sort of trajectory, and there are some conditions that we derive in a paper about 5 or 6 years ago, and if those conditions are met, then effectively you get classical trajectories out of this formalism. So the question then is, well, do those inequalities work? And what we did was we looked at a Duffing oscillator, which is a quartically nonlinear system, a sort of classic chaotic system, and you can see how well those inequalities work. If you have a fairly weak measurement, the state, which in this case is just a probability distribution of for x, is spread all over the place. But if you have a much stronger measurement, you see that it's localized, and this thing really moves around, and that gives you a classical trajectory. If you look at the classical versus the quantum problem in terms of maps, so this is the stroboscopic map in the classical case, this is the stroboscopic map in the quantum case, at strong measurements, not too strong because you don't want to flood everything out, but satisfying those inequalities I mentioned, and the two are essentially indistinguishable. So what's the point of this? The point of this is that we have shown that you can get a perfectly decent notion of classical trajectories coming out of observed quantum systems, and that's very nice. And we have also shown that those trajectories can be chaotic. So there's no problem in the sense that quantum mechanics and chaos are completely consistent, provided you're in the classical regime. So why is there a problem? And the reason is, or why did people think there was a problem? The reason was that if you look at bounded closed quantum mechanical systems, they have discrete spectra. And if you have a system with discrete spectra, then it's basically quasi-periodic and hence cannot possibly be chaotic. But that's obviously not the case for these continuously measured master equations, right? And so, in principle, what we have shown is that, you know, there is no in principle problem because once these inequalities are satisfied, you get classical chaos. Okay, that's perfectly fine. But what happens when these inequalities are not satisfied? You know, as an experimentalist, I can certainly tune my coupling to the detector and be in a regime where I have quantum trajectories, but they are not classical like at all. In that case, can I still define a notion of chaos? And that's the main point of this talk, the answer to this question. So chaos is measured. The only rigorous way to define chaos even today is through the Lyapunov exponent, which basically, given a time series, you know, which is a dynamical time series, asks what happens if you have two trajectories very close to each other? How do they diverge? Do they diverge exponentially? And if so, you know, what's the exponent? And if you have a positive Lyapunov exponent, then your system is said to be chaotic. Now, really, it's really a statement about the tangent space of the dynamics and not naively just a statement about how the trajectories diverge, but that's good enough for now. Technically, it's a little tricky calculating Lyapunov exponents because of known sort of standard difficulties. As I already mentioned, we showed in our original paper 6 years ago that basically if you satisfy those inequalities, right, then you got Lyapunov exponents in the quantum regime, in the classical regime, and we showed that you got exactly the same Lyapunov exponent whether you ran the classical system or whether you ran the quantum system. But we had used a sort of naive technique for measuring Lyapunov exponents, and it turns out this technique simply fails when applied to the regime where you're not in the sort of classical limit. So it took us several years to figure out how to do this right. And it's not because we are stupid. Well, we're not particularly smart, but it turns out this is extremely subtle. And it basically involves a generalization of the Lyapunov exponent that I mentioned earlier. And I don't, for the sake of, you know, not boring you too much with technical details, I won't explain the method in detail. But since we are at the Fields Institute, I want to show you couple matrices just for entertainment. which end up in this particular calculation. And this is quite remarkable, actually. So this has nothing to do with the rest of the talk. It's just, so forget the rest of the talk. So basically, what I'm showing you here is that suppose M is a symplectic matrix, and I can always write M in something called a Cartan representation, which is the exponential A dot F plus B dot G, where F and G are basically essentially Gell-Mann matrices if you're a particle physicist. I don't think there are any here. And then the idea is to be able to sum up this exponential in terms of explicit coefficients in which these matrices occur. So when I first explained this problem to a group theorist, they said, it is impossible. You cannot do this. So my collaborator and I, Rob Ryan, said, oh, that's a challenge, and we did it in 2 weeks. So mainly by writing things down on the blackboard and guessing. You know, we just would write things down and say, this term, you know, probably looks like that. This term probably looks like that. And that's basically what turns out. We also did it for 4 dimensions and 6 dimensions. I mean, this is for 4-dimensional phase spaces. And then we also did it for 6 dimensions, and then we gave up. But this sort of matrix decomposition turns out to be essential for many of the Lyapunov exponent calculations. And I would love a mathematician to explain to me exactly why this turns out to be the case, because I don't have any intuition for, even though the formulae are beautiful, I don't understand them. Okay, so back to the rest of the talk. So this is the main result. So the first thing is that if you were to calculate the Lyapunov exponents, it's extremely useful to have some, you know, asymptotic results that you know are true. So if you do something numerically, you're not fooling yourself. So the first thing that's really, really nice is that if you have a system that's not observed, you can still measure the expectation value of x for this closed system and try and calculate the Lyapunov exponent for it. Well, I just told you that the Lyapunov exponent must be 0. But it turns out that the Lyapunov exponent goes to 0 as 1 over t. And you can rigorously prove this. Yeah, no problem. And you can rigorously prove this. So what you can do is you can say, okay, if I'm at very weak coupling, I should for some time follow the k equals 0 curve. And then if something interesting happens, it should deviate from that. And that's exactly what happens. So if you have some weak coupling to a measurement, what you find is that initially the Lyapunov exponent falls exactly as predicted, 1 over t from the analytic asymptote, and then it peels off and goes to some finite value. And as you increase the coupling strength, the measurement strength, it starts peeling off earlier and going to other higher values. And finally, this is just nothing but the classical value when the classical conditions are satisfied. The important point to note is that that's an asymptotic object. It exists at t to infinity, and therefore quantum chaos exists. In the sense that you can be outside of the classical regime, follow quantum trajectories. If you're an experimentalist, do time series analysis on the time series that you've gotten, and you will find a positive Lyapunov exponent, even though Ehrenfest's theorem is completely violated. So that's a very interesting result. The other interesting thing, which actually I have a much better figure now, and Kurt's been running some more simulations, is that, in fact, as you vary the coupling strength k, what you see for the Lyapunov exponent, well, this is only for the Duffing oscillator, is that basically there's a power law fall-off with this coupling constant k. And we know that at k equal to 0, the answer for lambda must be 0, but we don't really know how it gets there. It seems to be power law, but we have no idea what the theory behind this is. So again, if somebody figures this out, you know, they should let me know. So finally, I want to end by just asking a bunch of questions, which I'm currently looking at. So just to give you an idea that this is a very interesting and rich field. So this is what I call a deep quantum regime, where these inequalities of how classical mechanics comes out are completely not satisfied. But you're simply looking at the quantum trajectories as, you know, dynamical objects. So how much do we know about this deep quantum regime? It turns out pretty much nothing, which is nice. So this is what I mean by a deep quantum regime, right? So there are two trajectories here. There is basically this is you're looking at the force. You're looking at the expectation value of the force, and then f of expect of x. And if Ehrenfest's theorem is satisfied, they should be identical. So at strong measurement, that's the case. At weak measurement, that's not the case, right? So that just shows you what the deep quantum regime looks like. So for example, in classical theory, there is a well-known fact that for Hamiltonian systems, Lyapunov exponents come in pairs. So is it possible that for the quantum system in the quantum regime, the same holds true? Is it true that the Lyapunov spectrum sort of, you know, symmetrically goes to 0? I don't know. But that's a good thing for mathematicians to think about. And basically, what is the precise role of noise, quantum dynamics, back action, etc., in controlling the existence of chaos? We don't know the answer to that either. And can these quantum exponents be connected to transport? So in classical theory, it's well known that Lyapunov exponents can be connected to transport. And it would be interesting to see if the same is possible here. And then by tuning, let's say, by spontaneous emission in an experiment, can we actually change the Lyapunov exponent as well as transport? The most important theorem in classical theory is, well, in classical mechanics is the famous KAM theorem. And the question is there an associated theorem for the quantum emergence of chaos? In other words, at fixed K, if I reduce H bar, the quantum classical transition moves to the left. And the question is there some abruptness? Is there a region of K where basically everything is quantum mechanical, then boom, it goes up? Or is it smooth? We don't know the answer to that. And finally, so I'll skip the middle point, you guys can read it, but finally, there's also the question of what is the quantum classical transition phase diagram, and is it somehow connected to the exponent? So basically what happens is that based on the inequalities I mentioned, if you have H bar here, the coupling strength here, which is like a new parameter, temperature, let's say, is over here, so that's for conventional studies of quantum phase transitions. What you find is that those inequalities break up this region into these pieces of an essentially classical sort of evolution, an essentially quantum evolution, then an evolution which is quantum noise dominated, an evolution that's classical noise dominated. It'd be interesting to see how this whole phase diagram works. But we don't know the answer to that either. So with that, thank you.